Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
My first guest this hour is one of those people who saw it coming. In January of 2007, historian Neil Ferguson wrote that it's entirely possible to imagine a liquidity crisis too big for the monetary authorities to handle alone. January of 2007, that quote. July 15th, 2007, subprime mortgage defaults can now have an impact on seemingly unconnected financial markets. And there's more. In fact, there's a lot more in Ferguson's new book, which is a sweeping history of credit and finance called The Ascent of Money, A Financial History of the World. A few chapters written this spring contained explicit warnings about the dangers of so many securitized mortgages seen in historical terms. So, Neil Ferguson, welcome back to WNYC.
Nice to be here, Brian.
A historian who maybe inadvertently saw the future.
Well, history gives you a certain advantage over people who work in financial services, because most of the bankers, including the real masters of the universe up at the top of the investment banks, were working with at most 25 years of experience. And since very few executives on Wall Street have studied history, and that tends to be fairly far from their sphere of interest, that means that they don't really have an awful lot of financial history to go on. Whereas I have been working on a financial history that covers 4,000 years. I suppose my real area of expertise is a bit more like 100 years back. And that meant that I had, a better awareness of the probability of something very big coming along, which the people in the markets just ceased to believe was possible.
You're best known previously for your book Empire and your writings generally about the U.S. and the U.K. as global empires. What made you turn to the history of money in the first place?
Well, empire and finance are intimately connected subjects. I only became interested in working on empires after I had written a history of the Rothschild Bank. And it became very clear to me that you could not understand 19th century imperialism other than in I suppose, modern terms, like globalization. The British Empire existed in large measure because there was what we would now call a savings glut in Western Europe, and that meant there was a great deal of capital that could be exported to the rest of the world from the City of London. And it very quickly became clear to people investing that money that it made a lot of sense if you directly controlled the countries that you were investing in. That much reduces the default risk of an emerging market if it's directly governed. And indeed, in the last chapter of The Ascent of Money, I talk about the first experiment with exporting Western finance to China, looking at the history of Hong Kong. We have kind of been here before, Brian. We've had an age of globalization when financial markets became very, very integrated worldwide. And we should, I think, have learnt from that globalization is quite a fragile thing. It can break down with extraordinary speed.
Which earlier age of globalization are you referring to?
I think if you go back to the 1870s and follow that period through to, say, 1914, you see a comparable level of integration of commodity markets, labor markets, and capital markets. Capital flows from Britain to the rest of the world were huge. The British were running an enormous surplus in terms of their balance of payments. And this meant that they could finance their empire. They really could invest in the railroads, not only of North America, but of South America. They could invest in the gold mines of South Africa. They could invest in enormous trading operations in East Asia. And so that's an important illuminating point that history can teach us. We have in some measure been here before, and we ought to be able to learn from that first age of globalization to avoid some of the mistakes that were made then.
Neil Ferguson, my guest on WNYC, and we can take your phone calls and web comments for him. His new book, The Ascent of Money, A Financial History of the World. We can talk past, present, and maybe even a little future. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 to talk to Neil Ferguson this morning, or post a comment or a question to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And I want to go kind of back and forth between the present and the past a little bit. You trace the roots of the Renaissance, which, of course, we think of as an explosion of intellectual enlightenment, to financial roots. Why money?
Well, you can't really have Botticelli if nobody can afford to pay for him, to pay for his paintings. You can't have the Uffizi if nobody can afford to pay for that spectacular building. Florence, if you visit it today, is one of the most beautiful cities in the world. And many Americans flock there every year to enjoy the splendors of the Renaissance. They very seldom reflect on how it was paid for, where it came from, and why it was that these Italian cities were among the most prosperous in the world. In the Quattrocento. And a very good answer is that in Italy, banking took a great leap forward between the 12th and the 14th centuries. And a particularly important role was played by the Medici. And the Medici, of course, are famous as power brokers of the Renaissance. And they were extraordinarily influential figures in the age of Machiavelli. But you must remember they began as bankers. And indeed, as foreign exchange dealers, the original money was made by a rather complex forex operation, as we would now call it, working in Rome as well as Florence and other Italian cities, collecting hefty commissions from transactions from one currency to another. And I find that fascinating. I know it's not as beautiful as Botticelli's Venus, but it still seems to me important.
So do you think that prosperity in general tends to lead to artistic and intellectual flourishing?
I don't think that's a given, but it's quite hard to have it without it. I mean, grinding poverty is not, contrary to romantic belief, tremendously conducive to productivity in the arts. And I think it's clear that if you go back and look at some of the most extraordinary creative periods in the history of Western civilization, they do correlate pretty closely with periods of prosperity. That's why I think the ascent of money, I mean, I play here on the ascent of man, Jacob Bronowski's famous history of science. The ascent of finance, if you like, is just as important a part of the history of our civilization as the rise of science, or for that matter, the rise of fine art.
And you note that society has generally seen credit and those who lend money as somehow parasites on the rest of us. You say that attitude has some historic causes. Want to tell us what they are?
Western civilization has a deep ambivalence towards finance. It is almost always the case that somebody at some point is complaining that the financiers are like leeches, whereas it's perfectly respectable to make your money from agriculture or from manufacturing because that produces things and you can hold those things, whether it's a bushel of wheat or a crankshaft handle. Whereas there's something intangible about money. There's something somehow almost invisible about financial services. You can think, I suppose, of a great many villains in Western literature who are financiers. You go back to Shylock and the Merchant of Venice. I talk a little bit about how he's represented. Or think of some of those wonderful 19th century characters. Melmoth in Trollope's The Way We Live Now, who's the absolute personification of the hateful financier. And it's no coincidence that both these characters are Jewish by origin. There's an extremely important theme in the history of finance, which is that the role played by certain ethnic minorities in developing financial services, not just the Jews, incidentally, but the Jews are probably the most obvious case, developing financial services and not getting much thanks for it.
But then we got from there to here, when credit has been considered almost a right and bankruptcy has lost the shame that was once attached to it.
The United States pioneered a far more liberal attitude towards bankruptcy than had ever been the case in Europe. There were debtors' prisons in England in the 19th century, at a time when it really was remarkably easy to walk away from debt in the United States. I mean, it really is up there with life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the right to bankruptcy in the American economic system. And that's something that's absolutely fascinating, because I think at the moment, as bankruptcies are inevitably going to rise in the recession that's now begun, Americans do have in some measure an advantage. They have a system which is in some ways better at dealing with economic failure than Europeans do.
So back to the present. If you see finance as kind of a mirror on our values, what did the housing bubble and the mass securitization of risky mortgage debt say about who we are, or perhaps who we were, as a society?
I suppose I see this as a political experiment as much as a financial experiment. In The Ascent of Money, I talk about the origins of the property-owning democracy as a concept, which is actually quite a recent concept. In the 19th century, it was never expected that a majority of households would own their own homes. In fact, in Europe, it was an aristocratic elite who owned property, and more or less everybody else was a tenant. It's from the 1930s that people start to argue, in the United States particularly, but also in Britain, that it's desirable to have people own their own homes, that it will actually influence their political and social outlook. They will become less susceptible to political radicalism as property owners. And so a whole set of institutions date back to the 1930s designed to make it easier to get a mortgage and buy a home. One example is Fannie Mae, about which we've heard so much recently, a product of the New Deal designed to widen, deepen, and underwrite the US mortgage market. We've been conducting this experiment in widening home ownership for decades now, since the 30s, and we sort of reached the maximum point with the subprime era, when we sought to increase the percentage of households owning their own homes up towards nearly 70%. And I think we just took the marginal tenant and turned the marginal tenant into a homeowner. We essentially invited people to join the property-owning democracy who couldn't quite make the payments.
The shame of debt was replaced by the shame of renting.
Renting certainly began to be looked down on. I mean, you could read articles by Skip Gates, my colleague at Harvard in African American Studies, saying what a wonderful thing Margaret Thatcher did in selling council houses to the working classes in the 1980s. In Britain, we ought to be doing the same thing for African American communities in the United States, because when they become property owners, families, whether they be African American or not, change their attitudes in positive ways. He wrote that article in the New York Times more or less the week before the subprime meltdown began, and I remember thinking it was richly ironic that this notion was being bought by intellectuals like him, because there was clearly a profound problem. The way that the subprime mortgages were constructed meant that they were almost bound to blow up after a couple of years, which made the beginning of this crisis quite easy to predict. It wasn't hard to see that as these mortgages reset, as the terms got nasty after the initial teaser period, a great many families were going to default. That was one thing about this crisis that was not surprising.
Especially because middle and working class wages in the last 10 years were not going up,
right,
like the top few percent.
I think
like the mortgages would have demanded that their wages went up.
We should look back on this as the age of leverage, as a period in which we used debt as a substitute for meaningful growth in incomes. And we're living through the painful end of this age right now.
Neil Ferguson, Harvard history professor, with also ongoing relationships with Oxford and Stanford universities. And sometime in and among all that, he found the time to write The Ascent of Money, A Financial History of the World. He's also, from things I've seen him say and write recently, one of the great pessimists going forward, at least in the short term, and we'll talk about that before we finish up. But Natalie in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Natalie.
Hi. Hope your cold's better soon.
Thank you.
I have read recently or learned recently in a discussion that the United States is the only empire in history, going back, I suppose, to the Romans and certainly including the British in the 19th century, whose empire wealth has not been determined by trade. I think essentially under 3% or about 3% of our wealth is determined by trade, or has been historically determined by trade. Now, I want to know, is that one of the major stumbling blocks in our economy recovering? And has that been an influential factor?
Well, Natalie, trade has become increasingly important to the United States in recent decades. The share of exports in gross domestic product has been rising steadily. And this recession would have begun at least half a year ago if it hadn't been for the continued growth of exports, which was really the only thing that was still growing in the last 6 months. In many ways, the United States has never been a more open, trade-orientated economy than it is today. No, to me, the big difference has much more to do with debt than to do with trade. The United States is unusual because it's a leveraged empire. It's an empire that relies heavily on other people's money to finance its consumption and indeed its real estate speculation. When you think about it, right now, and this was also true last year, the U.S. current account deficit is equivalent to 1% of the entire output of the world. And that means that a very large quantity of money has to flow into the United States from abroad.
we have the extraordinary spectacle of the United States becoming reliant on the People's Bank of China for a credit line that now exceeds $1 trillion. These are kind of mind-boggling numbers, but they certainly are historically unusual. 100 years ago, the British Empire was a creditor, not a debtor. Its power was based on its ability to lend to other countries, including Asian countries. So we're in this somewhat mirror image world in which the great imperial power, if you want to call it that, the great superpower, is in fact the world's biggest debtor. And there aren't many examples of that in the past.
From things I've seen of yours recently, you may be one of our biggest pessimists about the extent of the destruction we're now living through. Disabuse me of this notion if I'm wrong, but I saw you say on PBS last week there could be a depression, not just a recession. You could talk about what the difference is, really, and why you fear an actual depression.
What could be are the key words. I mean, it seems to me so far that we've avoided the mistakes of the early 1930s. That's why I've called it elsewhere a great repression rather than a great depression. We're repressing furiously with trillions of dollars of liquidity a very, very grave financial crisis indeed. So we're not there yet, but I don't think we can assume that we're home and dry, that we're safe. We're certainly looking at a big recession, and it's by no means clear to me that it won't be worse than that. Let me give you a couple of reasons why I worry, Brian, and it's not to be Cassandra. I don't want to be Cassandra, and there are some positive things I also want to say. But the things that worry me are, firstly, that the U.S. banking system, and this is also true in Europe, isn't really responding to the treatment. And the extent to which the big nine banks that got their chunk of the bailout money from Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson are now making new loans is negligible. In fact, they look as vulnerable, if not more vulnerable, than they were before the bailout. Now, since the real point of the $700 billion bailout is to get the banking system going again, the fact that it's not happening should make us very nervous indeed. The other thing that worries me is that nobody in Washington, and I've just been there, seems to have any doubt that the rest of the world will be happy to finance a $1.5 trillion deficit, because as these various bailouts and stimulus packages get put together, the amount of federal borrowing in the year ahead starts to explode. It's by no means obvious that, say, China, or for that matter Japan, will continue to accumulate U.S. Treasury bonds in the way that they have.
What
and
really
that's a
are
cause for worry.
What are their options? I mean, I think we've seen remarkably to me, but I don't know anything about this area, that as this crisis has deepened, the dollar has actually gone up
right. Versus
the euro and the yen when it had been going down before.
That may be a temporary phenomenon for the reason I've just given. If you have an absolutely huge deficit, an enormous surge of borrowing by the federal government, then at some point the market gets saturated. The Chinese have a dilemma. They are very worried indeed that their growth is slowing, that they haven't decoupled, their export sector is getting killed by the recession in the developed world, and they're talking about a stimulus package that will focus on boosting Chinese consumption, making the Chinese consume their own products rather than relying on us. If they take $500 billion or more and direct it into their own economy, that's money that won't be available in the way that it has been in the past to finance our current account deficit. And that's really quite a significant change of policy. Now, of course, they can't afford to write exports off altogether. They may try to have it both ways. But the key point is this, Brian. At some point, there will be a kind of saturation of the international bond market. The Ascent of Money has a whole chapter on the bond market, reminding readers that it was James Carville's famous line, if there was such a thing as reincarnation, he wanted to come back as the bond market, because that way you could really terrify everybody. I think the bond market still has the capacity to terrify us. If the cost of government borrowing goes up, if the 10-year Treasury starts yielding 4, 5, or even more than 5%, all kinds of problems develop in the United States that nobody really is thinking about.
Robert in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Neil Ferguson. Hello.
Hi, how you doing today?
All right.
Hello, Robert.
Yeah, just basically a question for Professor Ferguson. Could this crisis have happened without the influence of the securitization of mortgages? And what if banks had to make loans, depository institutions like they used to, and be subject to the Community Reinvestment Act?
I think there's no question that securitization has played a key role in the crisis. It was the process of taking mortgages, bundling them together, slicing and dicing them, and creating out of them collateralized debt obligations, which rating agencies said had AAA ratings in some cases, that allowed this problem to grow the way that it did. This was financial alchemy. You were turning lead into gold, but the gold turned out to be fool's gold.
And allowing a lack of transparency about the process.
Right. In a securitized market, no one can hear you scream is about my favorite line in the book. And the point I'm making there is that when you default on your mortgage in Memphis, Tennessee, the person who's actually going to lose out is at the end of a very long distribution chain from the mortgage originator through the investment bank all the way as far as municipal authorities in northern Norway, who suddenly discover, you know, they get a call saying, you remember that money that we were going to pay you through the CDO you bought? Well, unfortunately, there's been a little hiccup back in Memphis. And that's really the key to this process. An enormous structure of instruments, of securities and derivatives was built on top of the U.S. property market, including the subprime market. When that market went belly up, then down came this inverted pyramid of financial engineering.
We're almost out of time. We have Cornel West standing by, who's going to talk about what he calls hope on a tightrope. Certainly an age of hope with the election of Barack Obama for many, many people. I think you are describing the tightrope very well. And you even wrote in a recent magazine article that you pulled some money out of Washington Mutual before it was acquired by Chase, and I think really before it got into headline trouble, because you didn't want to test the FDIC. Mm. Now, I found that really disturbing. Do you fear that the crisis could even engulf government's ability to make good on bank deposit insurance?
It makes me very nervous that FDIC, that the whole system of deposit insurance, like the Fed and the U.S. Treasury, are being stretched to their limits, and indeed beyond them. Take the Fed. I mean, currently it's leveraged 50 to 1. Its assets are 50 times its capital. It's almost a hedge fund owned by the U.S. taxpayer, acquiring all kinds of very dubious assets from the struggling institutions in the private sector. When you look at the magnitude of this financial crisis, you really need to have an awful lot of hope, an awful lot of faith in President-elect Obama to believe that he can pull a new deal out of the hat, a la Franklin Roosevelt. When I said earlier that there were a few positive things I had to say, I'll say just one. I think we really do have to be thankful that there's been a change of presidency now. Remember, it didn't happen until 33 in the Depression. We're getting it early in the game, and there is an opportunity, I think, for Obama to change the national mood if he delivers the right kind of inaugural address. And the national mood is important. One of the points I make in The Ascent of Money is that finance is about psychology as much as it's about mathematics. And right now, the psychology is heading in very much the wrong direction. He needs to turn that around.
So last question then on that point. Does history suggest that this crisis will change our fundamental relationship with money or with credit or even with ourselves and our culture?
Our relationship with money will remain a love-hate relationship. We will go through greed phases and then we will be struck by fear phases. I don't see that changing. I think the most important thing to bear in mind, though, is that even in the depths of the Depression and indeed in the nasty 1970s, the United States continued to be an extraordinarily innovative economy. And my watchword at the moment is necessity is the mother of invention. No matter how bad things get, don't forget, we are good at innovating in this country, and if anything's going to get us out of the hole, it's not bailouts, it's innovation.
Neil Ferguson, Harvard History Professor, is the author now of The Ascent of Money, A Financial History of the World, published by Penguin. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Brian.
And Cornel West next. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.